The amount of ideas I have that never get done because I didn't have time.
You know
to
what
make
you
it?
Need? Personal assistant.
You want to pay for them?
No.
Broadcasting live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's time for Point Taken. Here are your hosts, Steve Scafidi and Kristen Bride.
Welcome to the Tuesday show. She's Kristen Bride. I'm Steve Scafidi. I've got now, after today, 2 days left of vacation. I know people don't want to hear that, but that's my reality. So I'm full in, though, on our conversations, just so you know that.
Oh, you are? You're not checked out yet?
I'm not checked out.
Thanks. Thanks for that.
I'm thinking about other stuff, but I'm also fully focused on the program. So you're not doubting that, are you?
I mean, I'm always thinking about other stuff, but that's just the brain of an ADHD person.
Well, that's what happens when you have a young child, two full-time jobs, and then other stuff on top of that.
Yeah.
That's a very that's busy a scheduling
social
nightmare.
Life. Including an awesome Brewers game last night. God, that was
you
fun.
You picked a good one to go to.
It was our friend AJ's birthday. Happy birthday, AJ. He works for Molson Coors at Molson Coors. And so we got the suite. We got the Molson Coors suite yesterday. Which was very nice.
16-2, is that what it was?
Yeah. And we had to leave early because we brought Frankie. But like, that inning was 7 runs. It was just, wow, that was just so fun.
I don't know if I've sat with you briefly at a Brewers game, but how engaged are you with the game versus just the social aspect of the game? I'm curious about that.
I mean, do you want like a number? How do you want me to measure
this? Well, percentage would be good. Yeah, like 10% game, 90% social?
I'd say 20% game, 80% social.
That would have been my guess. So I'm like 50-50. I'm there to watch baseball. As a kid, my dad was the weather guy for the Brewers on this station and other stations, and we got free tickets, so my brother Bob and I, we just hung out at the ballpark every damn day. They would just drop us off, and then we would just wander the ballpark all day. And
don't get into trouble.
Yeah. Who does that anymore? Nobody.
No one. You would probably get the police called on you if you did
now. We're like 8 years old.
Yeah, if you dropped your 8-year-old off, first of all, like, would they even, if you dropped your 8-year-old off and they had a ticket, do you think they'd let them into the game without a parent? I think no. I think they'd be like, where's your parent? And they would not let them in, even if they had a ticket.
The world's changed. Maybe not in a good way, but I don't know. Obviously, think bad things happen in some cases. All right. So I said in the break before we started that this is sort of a look at both sides, Republicans a little bit later, and now Democrats. It's election day in many places.
Is a 6+? Yeah. At least 6 primaries
Iowa,
today.
Iowa, California, where else?
Nevada? Or is it New Mexico?
I can just pull up the list.
Yeah, pull up the list. And so it was interesting because Axios put this as a big blue wave for Democrats and two paths forward. And kind of framing that a lot of the races that are happening today is the constant kind of fight that I feel like every year, every election cycle is this like populist, progressive, radical left side of Democrats versus the Chuck Schumer picked centrists or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because they, so this was the headline. Sorry. Democrats fight over party future is on Tuesday's ballots. And they lay out a handful of different races to watch where it is a more progressive, left-leaning candidate versus a more centrist candidate. So for Iowa's Senate primary, California's open primary for governor.
New Jersey,
congressional district. California, obviously, these are their new maps, and so watching certain races there. Coming soon will be Michigan and
Minnesota and New York.
Yes.
So those are all these are all key indicators of what might happen.
And I'm trying to compare it to what's happening when we were watching the Wisconsin's governor race. And, you know, I think a lot of policy stuff, there's been not criticism, but there's, you know, there's a lot of policy stuff for the 8 candidates that are similar, but I think it's fair to say Francesca Hong being probably the furthest to the left, having a lot of grassroots enthusiasm for her campaign, having some worry about her ability to win a general, and so some of the other moderate candidates, people being interested in. And so it's not like Wisconsin is immune from having this same debate. But my only pushback on this framework is how many other things go into an individual campaign. That it is not just like policies and the politics that are on the ballot for any one of these progressive and or moderates, right? It's how much money you raised, your personality.
We talked to Gilbert about that.
Yeah, right? Your charisma and how much you can actually communicate well. And it's not like just your policy or your politic that people go to the polls and vote on. And so thinking that like when there ends up being a mixed bag, which I'm sure it will be, I'm not sure you can be able to have this huge takeaway that like, oh, the populist sentiment or like the voters want this far left thing versus who ran a better campaign, who had more money. Because even in a Fran Hong situation, we know how much money she spent up front on a lot of her social media, both like for paid ads or organic or whatever. And like, will that leave enough money for her to get up on air for a media buy statewide? And if not, will that matter? Is this a changing of how campaigns are run in general? Like, there's so many different things that go into this than just a this versus that. What are voter sentiment? Where is the party going?
Yeah, I think in her case, for Jessica Hong, I think it's going to be an interesting litmus test on the value of someone who's that interactive with social media platforms and got into that really early at a high level, whether that's actually a real campaign that people will acknowledge and then vote for. I mean, that's the whole
question.
Or
if it's a strategy that will be repeated in the future.
Because if it doesn't work, why would we do all that energy up front?
Or spend that much money up front.
Yeah.
Because that's what, I mean, right? That's been the feedback so far every week when we talk about this with Bill and Joe, is how little money has been spent so far, and largely because donors have been on the sidelines. But as far, like in comparison to a 2022 Senate campaign, when he was saying how much Alex Lazary had spent at this point, how much Sarah Gadlewski had spent at this point.
Way more.
Yeah. But in the hopes that they don't run out of money at the end of this campaign cycle. But if you don't spend any up front and people are going into like the last six to 8 weeks still not knowing who's even running, are you really doing yourself any favors?
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned Fran Hong on the as far left as any of the candidates, right?
I think that's a fair.
Who's the most toward the middle, Brennan?
Missy or Brennan?
Yeah, that would have been my take. Do you think, I threw the question in your outline, do you think the party or voters, probably more accurately, will go far left, or will they move more towards a center leaning candidate?
I think I'm saying, going back to what I was just,
doesn't matter, like, personality.
I think it's personality. Who's run the better campaign? Who's spent more money? I think there's more things that go into it than just voters want. I do think there's something to be said as far as whether you talk about far left or however you want to phrase it. I think that there is still a populist movement percolating. Like, I think there is, when we talk about the K economy, we talk about the E economy, as Brian Jacobson yesterday, whatever you want to call it, there is an increasing frustration with a large part of the population that Trump got a hold of in 2024. I think there is, it's up for grabs this time around, of people who are, their wages are not keeping up with the cost of everything. They're feeling like they're getting screwed. They see like the top 1% getting richer and richer and just feeling like they are getting left behind, that we're constantly seeing these change elections that I think, depending on how you want to frame that, if that's like progressive, if that's populism, if that's a work-centered policy, but there is that I think if Democrats could get back to that, there are a lot of voters who they could tap into, but you leave the identity stuff as far as like race and gender and sexual orientation out of it.
All right. That was the Dem side of things. Let's talk about a tide turning perhaps for the President of the United States. Some interesting developments on a lot of different areas. Slush Fund, the 250th party, Iran, Kennedy Center, Ballroom. Are things shifting for the president and for Republicans? And does the president actually care about what happens in the midterms? Sort of another question we could throw in there. 855-616-1620. If you have a thought about what we just talked about or what's coming up, just text away. 855-616-1620. Very late for break. My fault. Quick break. Spent some time on the Dems, doing what Dems do, figuring it out. We're all trying to figure it out at some point, right? I'm trying to figure out how to pack for vacation. Anyway, she's Chris and I'm Steve. It is a Tuesday Point Taken. Thanks, as always. We always appreciate you tuning in. If you miss any or all of our broadcast, you can find it at WTMT.com. All of it right there. Every show, every interview. We're very active on social media. Kristen, way more than me.
Well, I need to.
I'm pulling back. You're still out there.
I have a backlog of stuff I have to get posted.
At what point does it not become relevant anymore? And then you just like discard it?
Oh, all the time.
Yeah.
The amount of ideas I have that never get done because I didn't have time.
You know
to
what
make
you
it?
Need? Personal assistant.
You want to pay for them?
No. Okay. No, but that's what you need.
I do. I agree. If I had the excess income to have a personal assistant, I'd be unstoppable.
Probably. Because, I mean, that's like the just the logistics of things.
Just like someone who I could like offload all of my thoughts to. Like,
what do you think my
this and then this and then this?
Off topic. What do you think my biggest logistical struggle is?
Scheduling.
Yeah. I just got too many things, like podcasts here, other show here, outdoors, this show, the occasional events that I do away from the show. It's just like too much. But I just do it. You know, I don't complain. All right. Speaking of complaining, the president, I don't know if you've been following Truth Social at all, man, and it is a...
I only see exercise. The Truth Socials as they make it to other people posting his Truth Social. I do not have Truth Social on my phone.
I don't either, but I see what other... And it's always, you know, it's always proliferated around the internet, what he does. But the president has been very vocal about a lot of things. And I sort of titled this, "Is the Tide Turning for Trump?" And I'm just going to list some of these things. Remember the big... We talked all long and hard about this slush fund. $1.7778 billion, whatever it was, basically for people that the president thought were mistreated or, you know, lawfare and all this nonsense. Turns out it's probably illegal, would have been challenged. The president's backed off on that. What was it, a week? 10 days? That's one. The president, he was all excited about his 250th party, celebrating the 250 years.
Well, there's two different initiatives going on that are getting confused for each other.
Yeah.
There's Freedom 250 and there's America 250.
Yeah. The president was disappointed in some of the entertainers. They were pulling it back because they weren't told what it was.
Well, I think they got confused. It sounds like for a handful of them, of the performers who have backed out since, which already were like, I wouldn't say, A-listers.
Wait, Milli Vanilli's not an A-list?
You know, like people who had their moment, but maybe their moment isn't right now.
Martina McBride.
But the confusion of the America 250, which is the like congressional, they've been planning this since 2016.
That's more the official one.
That's like the official one where there's like massive block parties and it's all these different like community events versus one big party. And then Freedom 250 is Trump's event that inside of that is like the UFC fight and a concert and like what's turning out to sound like it's going to be more
rally,
like a Trump rally.
Yeah. Which frankly, to be honest, he excels at. So maybe that's what he should have done in the first place. We can certainly talk about Iran. You could do a whole hour on just every day. This story changes.
Well, this was crazy from Axios yesterday of, sources telling, I think it's Barak Ravid and Mark Caputo from Axios. This was the headline. Quote, "You're effing crazy," end quote. Trump fumes at Netanyahu in a call on Lebanon.
Yeah.
And this also included, I think he says, "You're crazy and you're also, like, I'm the only reason you're not in prison." So,
Couldn't Netanyahu say that about Trump?
Some disagreements over what's next. Because, I mean, this is the crux of it, right? Like, Netanyahu wants to be in this war much more than America wants to be in this war.
He's a hawk. He wants to fight.
This is his opportunity to expand the boundaries of Israel. And so,
two things happened. On October 7th, he had the motivation to go full bore. And he had a president, Donald Trump, who supports at least at the time, supported his efforts.
Trump wasn't president at that point.
I know, but he was saying he was running for president.
Yes, he was running
for president. I'm all in on Israel.
Yeah.
So that's those two things led to this.
So the conversations around the ceasefire with Iran, obviously a thorn in our side is Israel having fairly different motives as far as what it looks like to end this than we do.
Yeah. So that's one. Another one. Kennedy Center. I applauded almost out loud in my car when I heard that they have to take Trump's name off. It can't be appealed, by the way, which I thought was interesting. Why that is, a lawyer will have to be smarter than me to tell me that story, but they have to remove it. They had 10 days to take his name off the Kennedy Center. And it sounds like the president's backing off of that one as well. He's like,
lost interest.
Yeah. Washing his hands of that. And then his ballroom thing that's still floundering. He says it'll be done. He being the president, it'll be done by the time he leaves office.
Well, it's tied up in court right now.
Yeah, I can't imagine that that's true. And if you've seen, it's all over the internet. The must be a drone picture of the site. So if you got the UFC thing going on, which just dwarfs the White House, and you've got the east side of the White House, Anybody who's been to Washington, D.C. or visited the White House, that's where the public comes in for tours and all and parties and all that stuff. It's just a minefield. It's all destroyed and dug up and, massive trees, historic trees taken down for the project that got no approval. Just he said, let's do it. So all of these things suggest to me that the president is sort of losing some steam, some momentum, and will the kicker for all of this be the loss in the midterms? And you know, Ezra Klein, you shared with me this morning, says maybe he doesn't care about that.
So let's take a break and come back, because that was I saw that yesterday, as Ezra Klein making a new argument as far as what Trump cares about, and it not being the midterms, but something else. So we'll discuss that after this on Point Taken. All right. Well, we don't have this much time, but I think it's, well, maybe we'll bring it back. Oh, well, no, because you and Bill and Joe are not here on Friday.
But who is here?
Kyle Wallace.
Yeah. How about that?
He's not, he was in the producer's booth, but we'll talk more about that later this week. All right. But this is a theory, the pet theory from Ezra Klein right now, opinion writer for New York Times, is that Trump is not trying to win the midterms. Quote, I'm not trying to say he's trying to lose them, exactly. I just don't think he cares. And he goes on to make this argument as far as thinking that Trump's bigger priority right now is controlling the Republican Party, not necessarily setting up the Republican Party to win the midterms.
Kingmaker.
Not only that, but he makes the argument as far as some of these decisions of backing Ken Paxton, ousting Massey, and all these different situations where they are, choosing the folks who are the most loyal to him over the folks who maybe were most likely to win, because he wants to be protected by the party, even if it means losing the midterms.
Yeah, maybe.
It's an interesting theory.
But Trump is about Trump and enriching himself as what he thinks is payback for the way he was treated in those 4 years between his terms is part of the story as well. So, to be determined. All right.
Well, welcome back to Point Taken. I'm Kristen, here with Steve, and I feel like at least since I've moved back, the last environmental story of things, of chemicals in our water has been about PFAS.
Yeah.
But the story before that story.
PCB.
Was PCBs. Yeah. But now that story is back in the news because Caitlin Luby and Tamia Foulkes from Milwaukee Journal Sentinel spent the last 2 years following one man's journey with navigating workers' compensation to get Tetra Tech to pay him for the cancer that he developed from being part of the biggest PCB cleanup effort in history to help cover for his medical expenses. And so I knew for a while that this story was coming out. It's finally out. There's multiple different aspects to it if you go to Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. But they join us in studio right now to talk about both the story itself and also what it took to report on this. So welcome, Caitlin and Tamia.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
So I guess for people who are, like Steve said, this was a story when he was growing up as far as PCBs, but because it's been out of the news for a little while.
77 they were banned, right?
79.
Yeah, late
70s. Remind us what they were used for, when they got banned, kind of some of the timeline as far as what PCBs meant in our culture and society.
Yeah, they were kind of used for everything. They were basically built to last. They are super fire resistant to chemicals. So they really took off during World War II, just because you could use them for so many different things. Quickly people learned that they were really bad for not only people, but also the environment. So the EPA inevitably banned them, but they're still very much sitting in our waterways. They're still, I think some kinds of paint have them too. So sometimes buildings can be affected. But the main story here in the Great Lakes is that they're still sitting in our waterways.
And why are they sitting in the waterways? Just because that's where things end up as far as, because they weren't, it wasn't like for the PFAS, it's because things get from the manufacturing for water resistant products, things end up in the water. Is this the same thing as far as what the manufacturing process was like? They just dumped things in the water?
Yeah, primarily it was paper mills that were dumping PCBs into the water.
Wastewater, right?
Yeah, it was wastewater. It was a really resistant chemical that they were using on a lot of paper projects. So ultimately, they were dumping that wastewater into the river, obviously not conscious as much of the health impacts that would affect people in the future. And it adheres to sediment. So a lot of those PCBs would sink to the bottom of the water, adhere to that sediment, and then affect wildlife.
On the history side of this, once it was banned, the companies that were doing this, did they willingly participate in cleanup over all these years, or they were like, you've got to take us to court and we'll see how it shakes out?
I mean, willing... Nobody
wants to spend money if they don't have to.
Yeah, I mean, at least with the case with the Lower Fox River, the federal government was able to get the paper mills to cover the costs of that. And I think, you know, there's different like Superfund sites where like it's partially covered by the government or the state. And then whatever company responsible for it ends up paying as well. So it's kind of it's a mix depending on where you are. But the Lower Fox River one was so successful in that way because it was covered entirely by the paper companies.
So going into this, because I feel like all these chemicals, like whether it's PCBs or PFAS or whatever, like, oh, like here's this new thing that can create these new products. And then maybe we'll think about the health and environmental issues as an afterthought. But they get banned. And then there's this effort to clean them up. But how much like foreshadowing was there as far as the protection of the people who were going to be hired to clean them up? Like, were there standards in place as the cleanup kicked off?
Yeah, we found that there certainly were standards. There are rules that companies can kind of choose to follow, and they pick a tier of the type of protective equipment that an employee would wear while working on this cleanup site. At the Tetra Tech facility, we found that they identified the lowest level of protection to be safe because they didn't think that the concentration of PCBs that employees would be working with would be high enough to mandate them to wear, let's say, like a hazmat suit or very specific types of gloves or respirators. And throughout our reporting process, though, we saw a lot of very high levels of toxic chemicals. They were testing these chemicals pretty much every day. And the doctors and experts that we've spoken to have identified that PCBs really have no safe exposure level. So it's hard to say, oh, you won't be affected by this, you know, no matter what, because we never know how the exposure will affect someone.
Because when did the cleanup kick off?
I believe it was 2004. The company, though, that we followed and were looking into, they took over in 2009.
Okay. And so at that point, did we also know then that like there's no level of PCB exposure that was safe? Or is that something we've known since the cleanup started?
Yeah, scientists have known for a while. There is kind of an issue, though. It's really hard to nail down environmental exposures with health outcomes. So while scientists and medical experts do know this, there are a lot of caveats when they talk about things just because it's so hard to pin specific exposures down to, say, like a specific kind of cancer.
It's in many of our waterways. And correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the reasons they created this new place on the lake by the Hohen Bridge is to put this dredged soil that's at the bottom of our waterways to sort of isolate it from the rest of us. Is that something that's just been ongoing since the late 70s? They've been just finding places to put this stuff?
Yeah, so these cleanups are happening all around the Great Lakes, and they have been going on here in Milwaukee for a while. So the new facility that is near Jones Island, that's like the newer facility, they had already dredged a lot and filled up another facility, right, and capped it.
Yeah,
so like, yeah, after this facility is done, which my understanding is MMSD says this year, after that, there will be more dredging along the waterways.
Okay. So let's take a quick break. We're talking to Caitlin Luby and Tamia Folks from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about their fantastic reporting on PCB cleanups. And when we come back, I want to hear more about both Scott Mesenheimer and other employees who have developed health issues and what their battle has been like with companies who don't necessarily want to be held accountable for it. So stay with us on Point Taken. Welcome back to Point Taken. I'm Kristen. He's Steve. And we are talking to Caitlin Luby and Tamia Folks about their new reporting that came out last week on PCBs and the fight for some employees who were part of the largest cleanup in history and the health issues that developed since then, but not necessarily getting the help that they needed in the aftermath. And so we were just talking about this. So Caitlin, so you got a tip 2 years ago that kind of set this whole thing off?
Yeah, it was actually a little bit more than 2 years ago. And then I wasn't able to work on the story right away because I had some health issues. And actually, like, that was at the same time, Scott, our source, he was in his third round of cancer at that point, too. So then, yeah, picked it up about 2 years ago and just started doing interviews. And
so what about the initial tip or the initial kind of like thread made you think like, oh, there's a bigger story here that we should track down?
I think, you know, it was just the information that he had. Something that's really wonderful about Scott is he has every single document you could ever imagine. I don't know if that was, I think it's probably part of like who he is, and also the fact that he went through a workman's comp case, but like he basically just handed us a ton of evidence and information, which was really helpful.
I was going to ask about Scott's story.
Yeah, go ahead.
I haven't necessarily gotten into it yet. So kind of just, I know there's a lot to it and we only have so much time, but as far as kind of the bigger plot points of what Scott's gone through after being kind of on the front lines of this cleanup.
Yeah, I mean, one of the initial points that I think he felt like was the point of exposure was that he was told to clean up a floor sweeper within the facility, and the floors were always really dusty. It was always, you know, a lot of dust floating around, and the main thing with PCBs is that you do not want them to get wet because it's easier for them to transfer onto skin or onto clothing to be absorbed. But also dust inhalation is also a concern. And so he had laid on the ground by this floor sweeper that had water in it, so the floor was wet, laid down a cardboard kind of sheet of, you know, box and tried to fix it. And then the next couple of months, he had saw this like small pimple appear on his back, the back of his left leg. And so that was the initial concern for him, because the type of rash that he got after being exposed to that water is closely linked to PCBs. But from our reporting, we just found that there were so many opportunities for employees to inhale sediment, to eat food in, you know, close proximity to it, which the doctors and scientists we spoke to said is a very, very dangerous thing to do. And so I think that the health concerns that were, you know, available for employees were numerous. And that was something that we discovered throughout the process.
For the public, there's also a fishing connection that you could, if you consume fish from these waterways past a certain level, and what is appropriate, what's not, you can add risk to your own body just by eating fish that you love to eat.
Yeah, so especially along the lower Fox River, even though it has been declared cleaned up, right now the DNR says it will still be decades before it's safe
really
to fish. You can, like, I think the limits are you can probably have like one or two fish a month, but like subsistence fishing there is still very much a bad idea. So it's going to take a really long time until, you know, folks can enjoy the waterway there.
Is that conventional wisdom, like for people who live in the area, just know, like, don't eat the fish there?
There are signs up in some cases. Whether people follow them or care is, you know, a different story. And that is kind of also what we learned during this process, is that in a lot of cases, whether it's workers who are cleaning up PCBs or people in the community who just like fishing, like people will say, you know, I'll take the risk because this is something I like to do or I need money. And that is, you know, a really tough barrier to get over.
Let's take a break.
All right, we'll take a break and we'll finish up conversation with Tania Folks and Caitlin Luby from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel on Point Taken. One more segment with Tania Folks and Caitlin Luby from Milwaukee Journal Sentinel talking about their reporting on PCB cleanup and accountability for the companies that were responsible for the cleanup. So I guess with this new reporting, because that is part of this, right, as far as the ongoing legal attempts from Scott Meisenheimer and potentially other employees to get help with their medical bills. What is the next step for them as far as what's been proven, what's not been proven, what's hard to prove to help them? Because what was his total right now? It's like $1.2 million for what his medical expenses have been.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, I think at this moment, Scott is at a point where he has connected with a new attorney who's expressed some interest in helping him with his case. I think at this point, it's going back and trying to argue with Tetra Tech and also his insurance company to make sure that they're charging AIG, which is Tetra Tech's insurance company, for his bills. He told me last week that for the first time, he had got like a $30 copay instead of one that was several hundred dollars. So it seems like there might be some movement there. But I think for him and for other workers, it's going to continue to be hard to prove. And they're going to need, you know, a strong legal team and lots of documents like Scott has to be able to prove those cases.
Are we anywhere close to the end of this story where companies who did these types of things are actually admitting they are doing these things and then compensating the communities and or individuals who have suffered from them?
I mean, I would hope so, but at the same time too, it's, you know, every decade there's a new contaminant that's out there, whether or not it's trying to like reconcile what's going on with PFAS. There's microplastics, which we don't really have a handle on. And I mean, there could be a new contaminant out there right now that people don't know about yet. So, I mean, hopefully these things get better, but it seems to be a story that keeps repeating itself.
In the environmental reporting that specifically for Caitlin, since people probably don't know that you also have a PhD, you were a scientist before you were a journalist. What industry or company has been maybe the gold standard when it comes to taking accountability? Like, have any of them been good actors in the aftermath that we can point to as saying, this is how it should be done?
I really don't know.
Really?
I can't really name any off the top of my head. There may be some on a smaller scale, but, you know, the big corporations, I can't really think of any, unfortunately. Ugh. So
this isn't a journalist question, but it's just a human being question. What did each of you learn from covering this story over the last 2 years?
Oh, gosh, so much. I would say a big thing that I learned from Scott was just how to advocate for yourself. Like, he wasn't always successful, but he kept on, you know, trying to get records, trying to get people to help, and trying to get help with like his doctors and whatnot. So I learned a lot in really just like resilience and making sure that, you know, you're just advocating for yourself, keeping good paperwork or files. That's something that I've learned.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, yeah, like Caitlin said, Scott is the dream source, I guess. He has all the documents. I tell people all the time when they come to me with story ideas, you know, I tell them, you know, documenting things is the most important thing. And I think, you know, being able to see someone advocate for themselves so fervently was really inspiring, I think, as a reporter. But I think we're in a, you know, landscape where people run into tough situations all day. And in my role as a public investigator, that is, you know, the main thing, trying to help people navigate and seek accountability for those problems. So I think I got a little hope from this story and also just, you know, loved working with Caitlin and learned a lot about, you know, how to do good journalism through this project.
It's not good journalism, it's great journalism. That's one of the reasons when Kristen said, let's get him on. This is how it's supposed to be done. It's a great example to young journalists. And we have a whole bunch of them in this building that this requires a lot of homework, a lot of research, a lot of investigation, and you put it all together into a fantastic series. So well done to both of you.
Thank you.
All right, Caitlin Libby, Tamia Foulkes, thank you so much for staying with us today, and congratulations on the story.
Thank you.
All right, we'll be back after this on Point Taken.
Broadcasting live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue, it's time for Point Taken. Here are your hosts, Steve Scafidi and Kristen Braun.
Welcome back. All right, so this is one of my, I don't know if it's a boomer take, but it's one of those takes that I think people might be surprised when I say.
You have a boomer take?
That I am, I'm not anti-working from home. I kind of am anti-working from home, like if that's all there is. I think in the aftermath of everyone trying out COVID and the opportunity to work from home full time, I think it was good to prove that people can work from home. And I think as social creatures, it is better when we work in an office.
Absolutely.
So that is, I think, but I do think there's, I think employers should be flexible as far as, all right, people can do this from home. So if your kid is sick, or if you have to go to a doctor's appointment, or like the ability that we're all working more hours than when we're actually in the office, that there should be some give and take. But hiring a person who's fully remote, I think, creates its own challenges. And I'm not alone in this fact. So turns out that one of the reasons for higher unemployment for young people, so for recent grads, obviously we've all been pointing our fingers at AI, which I think is still part of it. Mm-hmm. But turns out there's a new study that shows that it's also because a lot of companies do not want to hire a young person for a fully remote job, which I thought was interesting.
I think it goes back to the skills that you develop when you're in a workplace that has vibrancy and interaction. And, you know, we were upstairs after the show yesterday and we were talking to our new group of interns.
Summer interns.
Which always amazing to hear their stories. And our other teammates. I'll drop a number. Remember I dropped a big number on you yesterday?
Yeah.
Okay. In 2019, the people who worked from home in the country based on Bureau of Labor Statistics and census data, 5.7%. The next year, pandemic, 35 to 50%. And then it sort of ticked back down, 17.9, 21, 15.2, 13.8, 24. The last full year of all the data, it was 15. You know what jumped up in the last year to 22%? So more people, which surprised me. And I have to think it's people are choosing that route because of the flexibility it gives them. But I completely agree with you. On skill side, you subtract some of the things that you put in your tool belt because you're not having that style of interaction face to face.
You can't learn things over Slack in the same way. As far as like I was just talking to one of our coworkers today as far as learning how to edit videos more efficiently using different types of software. And in reality, the most useful thing for me, who's been editing videos on Adobe Premiere since 2017, 2018, like me trying to remotely train someone to use that software is just not even really possible, right? But me sitting next to someone and looking over their shoulder and be like, all right, show me how you do this. And let me look at, like, once I see it, I might be able to point out faster ways to do this. Have you looked at this and this different tool of how to do something? And like, that's the kind of interaction you can really only do in person. And on top of that, it's the same thing with like actually building the relationship you need to have, you know, to kind of this like banter with people, right? Like, it's not stuff that like the efficiency of, I'm going to like just Slack a joke unless we already have some kind of rapport with one another. But you only build that rapport by being in person together.
But we know why this is a desirable way to work for a lot of people. Childcare, right? You can figure it out easier if maybe you can sort of, if you don't have a very public-facing job, if you're on the phone, a little more challenging. But if you're, it doesn't matter what your child is doing in the backdrop, whether they're taking a nap or squawking or whatever little kids do. That's what little kids are like. You can sort of get away with that in some
jobs.
I don't
know if that's a leading thing, because anyone who's ever tried to work from home and have a child without any childcare in the home,
yeah.
I don't think that's really happening.
I know it happens because I know people that do it. So, I mean, that's one. It's not the leading one.
I think it's
the other one is transportation
to, like, go pick
costs.
Them up from school and,
yes,
and do things like that. Of like having, since school is different hours than the workplace.
Right. Transportation costs.
Yeah, absolutely.
Gas. Train into the downtown area, wherever your office is, all of that stuff.
Well, and some people, so I know some people argue that they are more efficient at home because there's less distractions, which I do believe that. I just think that there's still things that you gain from being in a social setting, anything that requires any kind of collaboration or group project, or you teaching someone else. And I totally agree for recent grads. Like, I remember, I forgot how old I was when I realized, because you know when you're first graduating college, and so many of the jobs that you want, you look at, especially as a female, you look at the requirements or what they say is like they what you need to have that job. And so often, all of a sudden, you see something that needs like 5 or 7 years experience. And when you're an undergrad and you're just starting out, you're like, well, how am I supposed to get experience if none of these jobs will hire someone with no experience? And then you end up getting like the sales job where you're just cold calling all day. And you get experience, and it sucks because cold calling is the worst, but you get experience. And I remember some point in my late 20s realizing that there is no amount of intelligence that replaces experience, right? In like what it is to actually just be in an office and do a job and be confronted with different problem set, like a different set of problems that you were like require solving. And like, it's only by putting the hours and years in that there's a certain acumen that you get that can't be replaced with any kind of degree. There is no shortcut to it.
No, it's the value of human interaction in a professional setting. You pick up skills. I learn things every day from people that I work with that I never would have done at home. I'm just seeing things. Like, oh, how do you do that? It's the show me thing, right? You were talking about the example of...
Tell me how you do that.
Yeah, you could do it when you're sitting next to them. You can't. It's much harder if you're at home and they're somewhere else.
But this becomes a harder thing now because... Well, let's go break.
Yes.
Come back, because I want to talk about, like, what are we going to do with young people between this part of it with being the remote jobs, the AI part, because then if we're replacing entry-level jobs with AI, then how are young people ever going to learn the skills to be above the AI?
And just beyond, even beyond the professional piece of that, We don't want, I don't want younger people spending more time isolated and by themselves.
Exactly.
Quick break. She's Chris and I'm Steve on a Tuesday. Yeah, Tuesday on Point Taken. It's a fascinating topic because I know I have friends who are my age, basically, who have worked in the financial sector, basically remote their entire careers.
They started out remote.
Yes. Data analysis. All you needed, they were at phones first, then computers, laptops.
Because we're having people text in talking about how work from home like has changed their life and how great it is for them. And I'm not trying to take away, I think the point of this article specifically is not talking about people who have gained experience, whether that was 2 years, 5 years, 10 years in the workplace and have enough experience that they are very self-sufficient working at home. This is talking about people who have just graduated, who have do not have that experience that they can take to an isolated setting of working from home and not even knowing what the right questions are to ask their coworkers who they've never met. And I think that is the difference here as far as being a young person who is still learning things about their career. I understand the convenience and the flexibility is a good thing. But there is something to be said as far as being around people who can teach you the job that you're doing that is just not the same if you're at home and you've never actually worked a job.
Think about it from the education perspective. If I said to a young person, you're going to go to a four-year school, you're going to have one-on-one instructors, you're not going to interact with your fellow students, what the hell kind of a university experience would that be like? Part of the magic of it is interaction in your lecture halls, interaction outside of your classes, interaction with teachers face-to-face. Whether that's help, I don't understand this, or brilliant essay, Kristen, tell me how you got there. That stuff is priceless. So if it matters on that side, why would we think it doesn't matter when it comes to employment? And so all the texters, yes, there are people that are introverted. I get it. And some people are super shy. But I work with people that are like that, and they do just fine in this very loud, active work environment. I don't know if we want to protect people because they're introverted. Live life. If you don't want to be a boisterous radio talk show host, work at a radio station and don't do that job. It's like, why would you want to shelter yourself because you're shy? I don't get that. I just don't get it at all. That was a couple people texted about that. Another one, I mentioned transportation. Parking costs. Working in downtown, not cheap. Cost of lunch every day if you don't bring your own. All these things add up. If you don't have that and you're remote, it is a lot sexier to not have to pay those bills at home and still do your job. And there are people, as we're talking about this, that excel working by themselves. And God bless you. If that works for you and your company, I would never say get rid of that. That's you made it work. A lot of people are wired that way. But I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all, which is probably why, 57% of the population works in a hybrid environment. Maybe Fridays they don't go in, or maybe Mondays they don't go in. Maybe they do a version of that. Now we have the modified schedules for healthcare, where it's 3/12, you're done for the week. All of these things have changed the dynamic of workplaces. Those are good things. But I do worry about young people. We spent time yesterday talking about this. I think we have to start thinking about this stuff, and not just young people thinking about it. Old guys like me, whatever you are at 39, almost 40, how do you classify yourself now? You're not middle-aged yet, really? 40s middle-aged?
I think middle-aged. I am. Are you middle-aged? Isn't 40 middle-aged?
I don't know what the definitions are.
I think for, like, if you look at, like, the average lifespan, I think I am over halfway.
Yeah, well, it's higher for women than men, so maybe not. If someone has the
average life, like, 76 right now?
76? Is that what it is? For women?
I don't know if it is.
I'll Google that, or I'll chat GPT that during the break.
All right, figure
it
out.
Let's take a break. I love the texters. Some people really, really weighed in here, so I appreciate that involvement and that engagement. We're just getting warmed up. We got a special guest at 11:35. Actually, two special guests.
Ooh.
A treat. I'm not going to tell you who it is because I want to just reveal it at 11:35. You will love it, though. And it has something to do with public safety. We'll tell you that. Quick break.
Welcome back to Point Taken. I'm Kristen. He's Steve.
So you asked me a question during the break, like Gen Z, looking at that group of our workforce.
Like, where are they working?
So they make up 18% of the U.S. labor force.
Okay.
18%. So one in five. Due to the shifting economic career dynamics, 52% participate in the gig economy. Freelance work. 52%. Big number. 42% are employed or in or actively pursuing skilled trades. Interesting.
42%?
Yeah.
So how many are in... like office jobs.
So let's see, 41%. What did I just say? 42. Doesn't break it down, but retail and hospitality, healthcare support, digital gig work, and then the skilled part is electricians, HVAC, plumbers, solar panel installers, which is, used to be a big thing. Here's white collar jobs. Sales, 14%. Marketing, advertising, 14%. Operations and strategy, 12%. Human resources,
12%. I feel like 12%. This is too many numbers. Yeah, this is adding up to be over 100%.
No, it actually adds up to 100%, but they're all the same. Sales, they're basically, that part is all divided equally. The white collar jobs.
Okay.
So,
because part of this story, this all came from Morning Brew as far as the looking at Gen Z being looked over for remote jobs because companies don't want to hire someone who doesn't have experience to do something that where they can't learn from other people. But then the thing is that also where they're getting the short end of the stick is for millennials who have the experience to be able to work from home. Even for Gen Z, who's being forced to come into the office because they're like, oh, you can learn more by being in the office with other people. If there's no one older and more experienced to be in the office because all the millennials are working from home, they're getting the short of the stick there too. So this comes back to, I think, between AI and the culture of, you know, it just goes back to being an apprentice, right? And they're not called apprentices always, but the passing on of knowledge to younger folks by them going through, you know, the ranks of what it is to do a job is still how you pass on knowledge and how you train the next generation. And if we're replacing them with robots because it's more efficient to have AI do some of those jobs, who's ever going to learn the job in order to replace the people who are doing it now that AI can't necessarily do?
Here's another number. 55% of Gen Z employees support AI and employment. So
Say that again?
55% of that generation, Gen Z, actively supports AI in the workplace. So they're open to the idea, even though in some
cases. It's interesting because we've seen all those commencement speeches where the commencement speaker was getting booed for mentioning AI.
Yeah. Again, AI is coming. Booing it to me, it's like, figure it out. Make it work for you. Make it work for your company. I guess that's the way I would look at it.
Are you worried about how it will stifle creativity?
Yeah, I mean, there's a threat there, obviously. When you can create music or the written word, and it's hard to tell the difference.
Well, just if everything starts sound, because if it's only built off of other people's work and people keep using, like, doesn't it just eventually start recycling ideas? And so everything starts to look and sound the same instead of actually tapping into human ingenuity and coming up with new ideas and new problems, ways to solve problems.
Yeah. I mean, it's not perfect. And again, I've talked about this before, the fact that basically a few rich guys dominate the industry, we should be worried about that. Because as much as we talked about yesterday, women dominating all those new jobs, that's not the case in AI. Is there almost a trillionaire woman that's going to be running an AI company? I don't think so. And there's diversity of gender also often leads to diversity of thought. So if you don't have that one, that extra piece, what are we going to get from AI other than a male-driven idea of what the future should look like? Like Elon Musk basically personifies the industry, if you want to think about it that way. Brilliant guy, but just warped in some weird, weird ways. That's not a positive to me.
Are you excited about the SpaceX IPO?
No. I don't wish them harm or bad fortune when it comes to that stuff, but they're rich enough. I guess I could make the kind of argument that it allows the regular folks to get into the, I guess maybe that you can make that. I'll invest in AI, and maybe I will at some point. But anyway, we've got to get to news. We've got a special guest coming up, two special guests, which we really are thrilled about.
Honoring those who put their lives on the line to serve our communities. This is Steve Scafidi's Salute to Service, presented by Waterstone Bank and sponsored by Mission 94. Here's Steve Scafidi and Kristen Bry.
And yes, it's a bonus segment or two.
People probably thought they were like, is this a rerun from two weeks ago?
Well, if you remember the story, Officer Sean Burger, Milwaukee Police Department, could not make it. They had a family situation they had to deal with. But now, in studio, from the Milwaukee Police Department, Sean Burger, welcome.
And?
Thanks for having me.
And who is with you?
K-9 Apollo.
Yes! The superstar K-9 officer of MPD. And if you don't know, yeah.
Not only that, but if you're watching the YouTube stream right now, you can see the... Well, you can't see Apollo, the actual dog, right now because he's a little too low. But you can see the Apollo stuffed animal that I'm so excited to give my toddler. She's going to love So there's Rocky and then there's Apollo. Yeah. Where did you get these made?
Company, they make them for our foundation. So then the handlers order their own for their with their dog's name on them. Though they have generic ones that they'll sell with no names on them.
It's just like another great way, because when we talked in our interview for the feature that we played last week, it's another great way to connect with the community. Mm-hmm. And that's a big part of your sort of mission statements about what you do as a canine officer and you working with first Rocky, then Apollo. So first of all, congratulations. I mean, honor well deserved. I love telling these stories. And you were nominated by your wife, Amy.
Yes, I was. Yeah. Thanks for having me again. And I really appreciate you honoring the men and women that wear the uniform.
So tell me about it. What is it about being a canine officer that you just love?
I think that the fact that you have a live animal, there's a lot of unknowns in that. And training them to do the tasks that you're asked to perform. And they can either make you look really good or they can embarrass you in front of your coworkers.
Are there... Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, so what's... How long were you serving as an officer before you made the transition into working with the canines?
So I was a cop for 11 years before I got a dog, and I've been a canine handler for just a little over 14 years.
And now. Lead trainer.
Yeah, I'm the head trainer right now, yeah.
And how many canine officers are, how many dogs are there?
We have six patrol dogs, or like Apollo, so apprehension, building search, stuff like that, narcotics, firearms. Then we have six EOD dogs, like you'd see at the Brewers games, the Bucks games, and then we have four.
What's narcotics stand for?
Explosive ordnance.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yep. So it's a polite word of saying bomb dogs.
Yeah.
Is it true that canines can only be trained to sniff out one thing? So they're either going to be able to sniff out explosives or they're either going to be able to sniff out drugs, that they kind of like have a specialty?
So we always say every time you slice up their brain to teach them a different discipline, you lessen their, they'll be always good at it. But they'll never be great. So bomb dogs are typically just bomb dogs.
Okay.
They get more bang for the buck out of him. So patrol, narcotics, and firearms. So he does three things.
How does Apollo or Rocky previously make you a better officer?
Well, I think you teaches you a lot of different things. Patience, a lot of patience, because they don't always do what you expect them to do. Constantly keep you on guard and. They are, I'm not saying anything bad about human partners, but I mean,
a good guy.
He's always has my back, every dog. Like they're seeing things that you're not watching from their vantage point behind me. Apollo's always turned the other way. And then I'll look and they're up, someone's walking up. I mean, they're just stuff you can't hear. So it's just very rewarding. And
how much training happens before you start to like, I know the breed matters because we can talk about that a little bit because there's very specific breeds that you guys use, men and women use. And, like, is there training that's done before the dog is presented to the department?
So what happens is now you see typically now because people can order these dogs online and have them flown into Chicago, wherever there's a customs. So we're getting them younger and younger. So typically we used to, when I first started, they're about 2 years old, very well seasoned overseas. They're vetted by the people that are training them, and then our vendor that we go through, they go overseas and they vet them. So by the time that we see them, we look for sociability, we look for drive. They're already kind of gone through that process. Not to say that they can't work out, things can go south, because some of them now, typically we're getting dogs 10 to 12 months old. That's still a puppy, just because you put the police title on them.
Right.
You know, you can still ruin them either way. You know, treat them as a pet too much.
How different are each of the dogs? I mean, do they have their own personalities, different skill sets?
Yes, big time different personalities. Some, they run the gamut. So you got, German Shepherd's a little more family, a little more calmer. Your Dutch Shepherd's, which he is, and your Malinois or Belgian Malinois, a little more high strung. Not to say that they can't be great around the family. They're just constantly go and go. He's eight, and he is still acting like he was 2 years old. Whereas Rocky,
although very calm today,
yes,
yeah.
Whereas Rocky, he'd get home at and he would just lay down on his bed and find his bed. He's still asking for the ball.
Let's take a break really quickly. When we come back, I want to know more about how they turn on and off as far as being at home and versus when they're working.
Even
and
on how, the job, how they...
Yeah, how that how that works. Because right now, I mean, I'm not seeing any kind of vest. So am I allowed to pet Apollo? We'll ask that when we come back on Point Taken.
Back to Steve Scafidi's Salute to Service. Presented by Waterstone Bank and sponsored by Mission 94.
Little bonus content for Salute to Service. And thanks to our great partners for allowing it to happen. Officer Sean Berger, Milwaukee Police Department, joining us along with canine officer Apollo.
Who we now have up on the YouTube stream. So if you're watching or you text watch to 855-616-1620, you can see a live shot of canine Apollo.
You had a question before the break. Now I've forgotten what
the question was. So I was going to ask, obviously, working in public service, working as an officer, there is it has to be a differentiation when you go home, right? Because it is a tough job. It is a stressful job. And how you are on the work, when you're at work versus at home, I imagine is a pretty strong distinction. And then is it the same thing for the dogs? Like, do they know when they're working versus when they can relax and be playful and be a dog?
Most definitely they know. Between Apollo and Rocky, we do a lot of search warrants with our tactical teams. Just the word search warrant, if you yell it loud in Milwaukee Police, Rocky would, before he passed, would still get up, even retirement, would get up and start barking. Same with him. And then everything's on command. So this is how we vet the dogs. Very social, stable. And then when you mention the commands that need to be mentioned, they turn and flip the switch. Now, if someone were to come up aggressing on me, they wouldn't need a command. They would just all of a sudden be keyed on it. No different than someone's personal shepherd that they had at home. If someone came to your house, that dog would probably key up on them and stuff like that. But yeah, they know we put the bulletproof vest on. It changes their demeanor. They know something's going on.
I remember it was you or one of the other officers I talked to last week or 2 weeks ago that these animals, these dogs, these partners improve the work that you do as a police officer. They make that, you know, the big conversation is community oriented policing. They can make you better at your job, and there's that interaction piece that I think the community respects as well. That's what I love about this story. And I want to give you a chance to talk about the foundation that's set up to allow this program to continue, because that's part of this as well.
Yes. We have it's MPD K9 Foundation. There's a website. If you choose to want to donate to the program or buy some cool swag, sweatshirts and stuff like that, or these animals that you see in front
available
of you.
Available for purchase.
Available for purchase, yes. They're great community. Like you said, you see him right now. He's calm. People can come up and pet him. I would recommend that you ask the handler before you just walk up to a dog and pet him. Some like their dogs to have interaction with people. Some do not. That's just a personal preference.
It's probably a good advice for any dog.
Yeah. I'm not going to walk up to someone's pet and...
I want to spend a couple minutes talking about your nominator, your wife, Amy, who's not here today. But it all starts with that. Somebody who reckoned, I've had sisters and spouses and family members, and neighbors and people whose lives have been saved, all part of that process. Amy is also in public safety.
Yeah, she works probation parole. Yeah, she's my biggest cheerleader, my biggest advocate. She loves, at one time, she was the head of the foundation. She's wholeheartedly invested in dogs. I think Rocky and Apollo both love her more than me. And that's fine. I'm okay with that.
Well, we are glad that she decided to nominate you. I'm always thrilled to share the stories. They're all unique, and I've had 9 years of telling some great stories from people who amazing work. The cool thing about public safety, and this started with my public career when I was a mayor, is you start to understand it's not just the title, it's not just the job, it's the person and the individual. I've met so many amazing people in the years that I've done it, working with and then now talking about or talking in studio with. I appreciate the work that you do, and I thank you for that work. And I know our audience does too, because I always get tons of emails about it. It's just a high standard that you have, but you show up every day, and even when you're off duty, you're still working. You're always thinking about these ways that you can improve your community. So I applaud you for doing that, and Apollo for doing what Apollo does.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate the recognition, not just for myself, but for everybody that wears the uniform. Appreciate it so much.
Officer Sean Berger, Milwaukee Police Department. A great bonus day of Salute to Service. So I thanks to all of our partners I mentioned them many times, Mission 94, and of course, Waterstone Bank has been with me since the beginning. We'll take our final break and wrap up our Tuesday edition with Kristen and Steve on Point Taken after this. We're looking at feet pictures popped up on one of our monitors. That's very, very gross.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's like a lot of bunions and corrective foot surgery.
Always have great shows on Wednesday, but I'm gonna be a fanboy tomorrow for at least part of it.
Yeah,
because Melinda Myers, who is an expert on planting and gardening.
So what? Tell me her story again. Because I was not familiar, which is showing my age.
She used to be branded as the plant doctor. I don't know if she still is or not.
She had a show on like PBS Wisconsin?
She had a show all over different stations. And I don't know if it was PBS, but local TV.
Okay.
For years, did radio shows, does live appearances. I saw her at the home show at the State Fair.
Okay.
She's an expert on plants and growing things. So okay. She's going to join us. And I'll let her tell you about the great events she's a part of, along with Chef Fecker, who was our guest last week. It was last week. I'm just going to geek out and ask your gardening question. So if you have a gardening question you want to fire off to us, the text line, we'll try to work it in tomorrow. Don't send it now because we'll
miss it.
We'll miss it.
Send it tomorrow.
She's the best.
What are you? What questions are you?
That's a great question that you just asked me. So I have this mini Japanese garden that I'm building on my property.
Like a bonsai tree?
I have a Japanese maple.
Okay.
And then shade hostas, and I want additional plants that would fit into that scheme in this little 10, not even 8x10 space in my yard. Okay. I've created a mini Japanese garden with a little structure. I want to ask her about
plants. Are you going to do like a little sand thing so you can meditate?
My squirrels would, the squirrels that dominate my area would just destroy that every day. Or cats.
But then you come back and you'd fix it. That's the whole point of a sand design.
I understand
how
it works.
It's temporary, and then you move on.
It's calming.
And then it's...
And as you know...
Lack of attachment.
Yeah, as you know...
Although that's more Buddhist than...
Yeah, I need more calming in my life.
You do.
Although I've gotten way better. You know this. My boss is shaking his head back there. It's like, whatever.
Have you?
Our time is up.
Oh, it is.
We'll be back tomorrow.
Midday
coming up after news.